All right. Good morning, everyone. Let's begin. So we're going to switch gears a little bit for today, and being that it's a very unique occurrence this year of a confluence of events, this Shabbos being Shabbos Shira, and also being the Shabbos of Tu B'Shvat, to be able to focus a little. So Shabbos Shira, as Yashir, again, we're all familiar with the beautiful, incredible, uplifting, seminal event of Yitzias Mitzrayim, of Kriyas Yamsuf. We actually dedicate an entire portion of Pesach, specifically again, Shviyish HaPesach, the last part of Pesach, to focusing on the Nes and the incredible miracle of Yamsuf. And we'll speak more about the miracle of Yamsuf in tonight's Parsha Shir. But this morning, I'd like to draw your attention to what I feel is an often neglected Yamtuf. And that is the Yom Tov of Tu B'Shvat. So again, for many of us, when our association with Tu B'Shvat is often Buxer, right? Which I think for most people does not bring up any positive memories, right? Again, I could honestly say my earliest memories of Tu B'Shvat is you'd get a bag in yeshiva, a brown paper bag, you'd open it up, things that look like fruit were in there, and again, there's this black shriveled up thing that they called buxer. You weren't sure whether or not to throw it or to eat it. What exactly was the avodah with this? And the truth is, and for a very large degree, we'll see that, especially outside of Eretz Yisrael, Tu B'Shvat is often an underappreciated day. And what I'd like to be able to focus, I know our topic is normally Tehillim, but you'll grant me a one-week reprieve from Tehillim to focus on this. But what I'd like to try to do today for the few minutes we have together is to try to understand a deeper meaning. We saw about Tu B'Shvat maybe 3-4 years ago when Tu B'Shvat fell out on a Wednesday. So, but, I'm sorry? It was a 5 years ago. Okay, good. Excellent. So, Mazel tov. So what I'd like to go back a little bit and try to focus on and develop a little bit a deeper meaning and a deeper understanding of this Yom Tov of Tu B'Shvat, and how to recognize that even for those of us who are still outside of Eretz Yisrael, this day resonates with an incredible amount of importance, and more importantly, an incredible amount of opportunity. So let's begin with number one. Shulchan Aruch begins with a simple statement. Nagu shlalipa al paneim b'Tu B'Shvat. The halacha is, the Shulchan Aruch says, or the minog is, that we do not recite Tachanun on Tu B'Shvat. Now understand, Tachanun, of course, is the supplicatory prayer that we recite immediately following Shemona Esrei. Just a very quick insight into Tachanun. Over the course of Tefillah, essentially we daven in all different physical positions. So we daven sitting down, we daven standing up. So we recite Shema, Berchos, Kriya Shema, sitting down. Shemona Esrei is standing up. And Tachanun is supposed to be in the form of prostration. Now, we don't prostrate outside of the Beis HaMikdash, leaving aside Yamim Noraim, whereby the recitation of Aleinu might be an exception. But under normal circumstances, we do not prostrate outside of the Beis HaMikdash. So the closest thing to prostration that we do is we place our head down on our arm. That's the quasi-prostration. And therefore, we've davened to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sitting, standing, prostrating. Tachanun in and of itself is a supplicatory prayer that discusses divine assistance in times of distress and in times of need. It's a very serious, heavy tefillah. You're saying to Moshe, I'm in trouble, I'm in difficult straits, I need your assistance. Because of the tone of that tefillah, any day that is a Yom Tov or has a Yom Tov-like identity, we omit the recitation of Tachanun. If you're of more of a Hasidic bent, so any time that there's a yard site, they often omit the recitation of Tachanun. Again, the idea being that the yard site, and even for those who are not Hasidic, many on Zayin Adar Moshe Rabbeinu won't recite a month of Nisan, which is a celebratory month, we do not go ahead and recite Tachanun. So any day in which there is a celebratory overtone, we omit Tachanun. So it is interesting to see that the Shulchan Aruch number one says that we don't say Tachanun on Tu B'Shvat. So already at first glance from this simple statement, what do we see from this ruling of the Shulchan Aruch? That Tu B'Shvat is a Yom Tov. Or that Tu B'Shvat at least has a quasi-identity of a Yom Tov, of a celebratory holiday-like day. And in fact, the Mishnah Berurah says in number two, B'Tu B'Shvat Shu Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos, V'Noagim HaAshkenazim, Laharbis Azim in Eperos Shel Ilanos. And again, all the Mishnah Berurah says is that the minog on Tu B'Shvat is to eat a lot of fruit. And again, specifically the fruits indigenous to Eretz Yisrael. But again, doesn't really shed much light onto what exactly is the celebratory nature of this particular day. So remember, if we go back a little bit, so if we go to the origins of Tu B'Shvat, but Tu B'Shvat is probably one of the most unexciting days you will come across from a halachic perspective, meaning it's a legal day. What do I mean by that? Take a look at number three. The first Mishnah Maseches Rosh Hashanah discusses the following idea. Arba Rosh Hashanim Heim. So the first Mishnah says there are four Rosh Hashanahs. There are four new years throughout the Jewish calendar. And again, the Mishnah says, Be'echar B'Nisan Hashanah L'Melachim Regalim. On the first of Nisan is the Rosh Hashanah for kings and Yamim Tovim. Again, we're not going to get into all of this right now. Be'echad be'elo Rosh Hashanah l'maaser behema. The first of Elo is Rosh Hashanah for animal tithing. Now again, what that has to do is, and this is going to be a common theme, whenever it comes to tithes, you can only tithe 1 year's produce from that year. So for example, there's an obligation to tithe my animals. I have to take 1/10 of my flock and give that away. The halacha is, I have to tithe from a cohort of animals born in the same year. I cannot tithe this year's cohort of animals from last year's cohort of animals. So as such, if tithing has to take place from that year's flock, by definition, you need a cutoff date. So what is considered, the same way that there's a cutoff date for school, so you need a cutoff date for Meister Behemoth. I apologize for that analogy. I don't mean to equate children with behemoths, but you understand. So he goes on, he says, that's fine. Next, Be'echer B'Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah L'Shanim, L'Shmitin, L'Yovlos, N'Tzili Rakos. Then of course, the Rosh Hashanah that we are most familiar with, which is the Rosh Hashanah, ultimately the new year of Tishrei, which is literally the calendrical new year. But here's the part I want to focus on. Be'echad b'Shvat, on the first of Shvat, Rosh Hashanah li'ilon, is the new year for trees. K'diri b'Shamay. So B'Shamay says the new year for trees is on the first of Shvat. Be'isilo says b'chamish asar. Be'isilo says no, the new year for trees is on the 15th of Shvat, i.e. Tu B'Shvat. So obviously we paskin like Be'isilo. We hold that the new year for trees is Tu B'Shvat. So what does it mean, the new year for trees? So if you look at number four, the Baal Tanur says very simply, Le'inyan Meiser Peros, Shein Ma'asrin Peros Ilon Shechantu Kodem Shvat, Al Shechantu La'achar Shvat. So the same thing we said by animals applies to fruit. That when tithing your fruit, you have to tithe one cohort from itself. So what's considered to be the beginning of the year of fruit and the end of year for fruit? So any fruit that blossomed after the 15th of Shvat is part of this year's crop. And again, of course, that'll go ultimately again to the 14th of Shvat the next year. So that's our cohort for fruit. So on a very simple level, the relevance of Tu B'Shvat is in a tithing agricultural society. It establishes the cutoff date for tithing purposes for fruit. So again, just to understand the purposes of this, remember we have multiple different tithes. We have Truma that we give to a kohen. We have Meiser. We have Meiser. Again, now there's an interesting discussion about how much you have to give to the kohen. We're not going to get into that right now. Meiser, after you remove your Truma, 1/10 of the remaining portion goes to the Levi. And then, of course, remember, the way the agricultural cycle is set up is that it's set up in a 6-year cycle, with 7th year being Shemitah. So on years 1, 2, 4, and 5, you would separate out, you don't have to remember this, it's not on the test, but on years 1, 2, 4, and 5, you would separate out Meiser Sheni. Meiser Sheni, remember, is an interesting tithe. It's yours to eat, but you have to consume it in Yerushalayim. And on years 3 and 6, you would separate out Meiser Ani, which is an additional tithe for the poor. So therefore, again, the Mishnah is telling me, how do I determine the tithing year of fruits of the tree? Tu B'Shvat. So whatever fruits blossom after the 15th of Shvat this year to the 14th of Shvat next year, anything that grows during that time is one cohort of fruit that must be tithed from within that cohort. Fine. So why Shvat? Why Shvat? Meaning again, if you go out and you remember, you can't judge Tu B'Shvat by America, by Golis, because remember, these are seasonal Yomim Tovim, which by definition are based on Eretz Yisrael. But even if you go into Eretz Yisrael, Tu B'Shvat, right, comes this Shabbos, what are you going to see on the trees? Nothing. Almost, I said, the one thing, interestingly enough, that does blossom is
almonds.
Good, right? Hashkedia, Porachat, right? So again, poppies. The almond trees, right?
Poppies,
but poppies is not a fruit tree. Mm-hmm. Right? There's plant life that blossoms, but in terms of fruits of the tree, it's really, again, the almond tree that really begins to blossom this time of year, but otherwise you don't see much. So why Shvat? So again, the Gemara points out over here In number five, the Echa B'Shar Hashanah Le'ilon, my timer, why do we go ahead and make the, meaning why the 15th of Shvat, why is that the beginning of the new year? Amar Belozer Amar Oshia, Afal Pi Sherof Tkufa Mibachot, because even though there is still more winter to come, in other words, winter is not over yet, so even though there's still more winter to come, Hoil the Yatsu Rav Gishmei Shana, by the time that the 15th of Shvat comes around, the majority of the rains have already fallen. And because the majority of the rains have already fallen, Rashi points out over here in number 6, Shekvar ova rov yimos agisham shuzman revia va'ala straf bilanos v'nimtzu aperos chomten me'ata. The sap is already rising up of the tree, and as such again, nature is already beginning to blossom, nature is already beginning to re-merge, to experience that renaissance for the new year. It's a beautiful idea, exceptional idea. But again, we're still based on one simple problem, which is, I understand why it's important from a tithing perspective. I understand why it's important from a legalistic perspective, but still, what's the Yom Tov identity of the day? Meaning, again, why am I not reciting Tachanun on the 15th of Shvat? What is the celebratory nature of this day? To take this one step further, which is quite interesting, if you look at number 7, the Mordechai, and you can see I put a little bit of a biography over here, a disciple of the Maharam of Rotenburg, lives about 1240, one of the earlier codifiers of Halacha. So the Mordechai writes the interesting discussion over here. Again, we'll get a little bit technical for just a moment. Shebikshu ligzar tainis b'sheni b'chamishi b'sheni. So remember again, there are those who fast Bahab, there are those who fast Mondays, Thursdays, and Mondays for a particular cycles. Upaga b'tainis tu b'shvat, yeishlochosh Rosh Hashanah v'litchos atainis olos. So they ask the Mordechai the following question. Let's say somebody fasts on Mondays, Thursdays, and Mondays, and one of those days happens to fall out and be Tu B'Shvat. Are you permitted to fast on Tu B'Shvat or not? What are they really asking the Mordechai? Is it a Yom Tov? That's what they're asking me. I understand. Is it a Yom Tov? Lamaisa, can I fast on it or not? Again, remember, Bahab is a significant minhag, a significant custom. Or for that matter, it's not just Bahab. Let's say a person has a terrible dream. There's a concept of a tainis chalom, of fasting. So can I fast on Tu B'Shvat or not? Or let's say again, it happens to be a person has yard site on Tu B'Shvat. So again, many have the custom to fast on a yard site as well. Right. Can I fast on Tu B'Shvat or not? That's what they're asking the Mordechai. Look at the Mordechai says. He says, Kach daiti nota, number 7, second line, Shatainis nitcha ad hashabes ha'achar, ve'ein kovin tainis bo bayom. So he says, the Mordechai, we do not fast on Tu B'Shvat. Why? Shalomatsanu tainis b'Rosh Hashanah. Because we do not fast on Rosh Hashanah. Now, this is a very dramatic statement. Now, the truth is, you should know, this is actually an interesting discussion in Halacha. Is one permitted to fast on Rosh Hashanah or not? So, again, we paskin that we do not fast on Rosh Hashanah. Even though logic would dictate that we would fast on Rosh Hashanah, as many suggest, because it is a day of judgment, but we don't fast on Rosh Hashanah because the celebratory and optimistic nature of the day eclipses the fear aspect of the day. So the Mordechai says, we don't fast on Rosh Hashanah, and the same way we don't fast on the first of Tishrei, we also don't fast on Tu B'Shvat. And again, if you look at number 8, the Shulchan Aruch says it, Tzibur shebikshu ligzar tainis sheni v'chamishi v'sheni. If a Tzibur wants to go ahead and establish a number of fast days, upaga b'tainis Tu B'Shvat. And what happens in the middle of these days, Tu B'Shvat comes up, hatainis nitcha l'shabes haba, so again, here you have the Shulchan Aruch saying explicitly, we do not fast on Tu B'Shvat. Why? Because it's Rosh Hashanah, because it's a Yom Tov. So here we have the Halacha telling us in two different ways that Tu B'Shvat is a Yom Tov. Number one, we will not recite Tachnun. We don't recite that supplicatory prayer for divine assistance, divine salvation from the straits, from the midst of sorrow. And number two, we will not fast on Tu B'Shvat as well. And the question, obviously, that we started with is just further cemented, which is, what is the Yom Tov identity of this day? We understand, again, the agricultural importance. We understand the halachic importance. We understand the tithing importance. We understand all of these things. But why is it a Yom Tov? What is the celebratory nature of this day? How is it a Yom Tov in its identity? So I want to share with you a couple of different approaches. Take a look first at number 9. So number 9 is a beautiful insight by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in his Sefer Drash Moshe. The Sefer Drash Moshe, which is on the weekly parsha, he happens to have a section about Tu B'Shvat. And he addresses this beautiful idea. Look what he writes, paragraph Aleph. The parsha Pshat Tu B'Shvat Amarti Tamal HaSimcha Be'etzem V'Shegam Ata Anu Smechem B'Rashon Lilonos Asher U'Shayach Rak L'Dinei Ma'isur Shein Ma'asim Mishan Al-Chaberto. So Moshe asks our questions. What's going on over here? It's very nice. Nature is rejuvenating. It's quite beautiful. It's wonderful. The trees are coming back into blossoming. And it's important from a tithing perspective. But again, what is the celebratory nature of the day? Shehine Yadua. Look what he writes. And Rav Moshe advances a beautiful insight. Says, Shehine Yadua. Sheshevet Levi lo natal nachala. B'chol Yisrael lachu nachalasim. Says something very interesting. The tribe of Levi did not receive a portion in the land of Israel. They did not get a tribal portion. Rather, what happened? They lived, there were certain cities that were designated for them, but they did not get a tribal portion. Rather, what happened to their portion? Rav Moshe has an interesting formulation. Their portion was given to the rest of the tribes. So you see, it's interesting. Under normal circumstances, so we think that Shevet Levi just didn't have a portion. They were never included. No, they had a portion, but their portion was taken from them and given to the rest of the tribes. It has to do a lot with the fact that the job of Shevet Levi is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are no distractions for Shevet Levi. Land ownership, property ownership, home ownership is a distraction, takes up a lot of your time. Therefore, Shevet Levi has to have a singular focus. So says Rav Moshe, their land was given to the other Shvatim. Vim came. Be'etzem ha'maisra shenostim lohem eina tova mi'yisrael be'etzem elachova kischirus. So Moshe says something very interesting. So what happens? We have to give the Levim maiser, right? We go out and we give the Levim, we give the Shevet Levi, trumos and maisrus. But Moshe says, those trumos and maisrus are viewed almost as rent. As rent, in other words, I am sitting on, I'm occupying the Levi's land, I'm living on land that really belongs to Shevet Levi, so I'm paying Shevet Levi for the right to go ahead and live on their land. That's the Trumas and Maisras. It's like the rent that I owe them. He says, Aval me'achar shu schiros kazeh, shatavu yibo litei l'mishe yirtzeh, ve'in lezeh tovin ve'in lochin mimenu, hasadik ishalo yitein, toa ha'adam lomar shu matana me'ito. But here's what happens. You see, what happens, for argument's sake, if you did not pay your trumas and maestros, what happens? What happens? Shemayim, that's wonderful. Okay, we're here. I'm not in Shemayim right now. Good. What happens? What happens now? What happens now? Nothing. The answer is nothing. Is someone coming to seize my land? Is somebody putting a foreclosure sign on my front door saying you're in arrears and your trumas and maestros taking you back? No, nothing happens. In fact, by the way, interestingly enough, even if a Kohen and Levi shows up at my house and says, hey, Silber, I heard you didn't pay your trumas and maestros, pay up. I could say, you're right, I owe it. I don't owe it to you. I owe it to you. I owe it to your Shevet. And I could choose to pay whoever else, meaning it's what's called Mamon She'in Alav Tovim. It is money that is owed, but there is no one specific that has the right to claim it. Mm-hmm. So on a technical level, although I owe it, nothing happens to me if I don't pay it. No one could demand it from me, nor could anyone repossess my property or my possessions or garnish my wages if I don't go ahead and pay it. And as such, because it's not something that could be demanded of me, it's easier for a person over time to begin to look at it as what? As a nice thing that I do. As a matana. This is something nice that I do for the Kohanim and for the Levim. So you know what happens sometimes when something is not an obligation, but it's simply something nice that I can do, what ends up happening? I don't do it. If it's not an obligation, meaning if I'm not getting a notice in the mail about it, if I'm not getting a reminder letter, if I'm not getting a little bit of like, you got to do this or else, so human nature is, I'm just simply not going to do it. So what happens? Furthermore, again, ultimately, a person can be reticent to give Trumas and Maestros. Why? Because remember, I'm going to give Trumas and Maestros. All right, I have this year, but how do I know what the crop is going to be next year? In other words, there's a concept. Having savings is a good thing. Why? Because at the end of the day, you never know what happens. So it's always good to have a financial cushion. You never know what's going to happen. So we know that's a very good mindset to have in life. right? All the more so in an agricultural society where there are even more variables. So Baruch Hashem, I have enough crops, I have enough produce to be able to give my chumas and my sus this year, but who knows? Who knows what's going to happen next year? Maybe I should put this away for now. And you know what? If I have a good year next year, Kohen Levi, I'm going to give you guys double. I'm going to give you double. So in order to prevent that from occurring, what happens? He says, "Va'af igam b'shana achar tzmiach b'tuv yachush lo b'shana shlishes ad shepitom yavo ido below yuchal shul v'kayim l'shayim v'lachin tzivsa Torah she'in ma'asin mishana alchaberto v'im ki muchrach b'chol shana l'shayim ma'isros v'roshu chov." So what happens? The Rebbe Shlom did the following, or Chazal did the following. They put in there essentially like a tax year. There's a tax year. So the same year we have a tax year, right? January 1 to December 31 of any year is my IRS tax year. So there's a tithing tax year as well. The tithing tax year is from the 15th of Shvat of this year to the 14th of Shvat for next year. And you have to dispense your tithes this year because you cannot tithe from one year's produce on the next. And by establishing a year for the tithing cycle, what does that do? What does that do? It makes it obligatory. What it does is, by giving it a framework, what it does is it makes it obligatory. Now I know that there's a tax year. There's a tithing tax year. It's an obligation upon me to give my chumas and maestros. Now watch this. Now here on Moshe, something so beautiful. V'zeu tam diyesh rosh hashanah l'din maestros u'bi'ilonos huyom tu b'shvat shu simcha gidola. Now says Rav Moshe something amazing. Go back to what he said at first. Remember again, Shevet Levi was not given their portion. Who was their portion given to? Everyone else. Which means every other Shevet has a share in Shevet Levi's rightful tribal area. Therefore, again, when we give Chumas and Maestros, what we are doing is we're really paying the rent on the land. It's very important you sowed. It's not that I'm doing something nice. Oh, Levi, I got your back. You know, Cohen, I've got your back. I'm gonna take care of you. Don't worry about it. No. It's not a tova. I'm not doing them a favor. I'm not some great Baal Chesed. I'm giving them what they are owed. And they're owed. Meaning, I'm sitting on their land. I'm using their land. I'm getting usage from something that was rightfully theirs. Here is the payment that I owe you. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, and in order to solidify this payment identity of Trumas and Maestros, Chazal created a tax here. Look what Rav Moshe writes. He says, therefore, Shu simcha gidola shebazeh naaseh hates chalokim shelo mamish. Rav Moshe says something amazing. That the only time you really own your produce is after you pay the Levi and the Kohen what he's owed. Only after you take care of your debts. Only after you take care of your debts. You know, like Lahavda, what it's like is, you know, anyone who gets a paycheck. So you know what happens if you open up your ADP statement? The first number there is, you're also removed from Gashmias. It's beautiful. So the first letter there is your gross pay, right? You see that number and it's so wonderful. And then what happens? Right? Fika, Micah, Shmika, everybody else is on there with their brother. And then you get to your net pay. In other words, but that money is not yours until you pay what you owe. Meaning if you take home your gross pay, although you might have more money, that's not your money. That's not your money. That belongs to the federal government. It belongs to the state government. You owe that to them. And in fact, the only time you get to take home your money is when you pay first what you owe. Says Rav Moshe, it's the same thing in an agricultural society. The only time your money becomes yours is when you pay off your chumos and maestros. When you go ahead and you pay the biblical equivalent of your FICA and your state tax and your social security, so when you pay your chumos, your maestros, your maestro ani, your maestro sheni, then everything else becomes yours. Says Rav Moshe, that's the simcha of Tu B'Shvat. Comes Tu B'Shvat, you have to make sure that what? All of last year's tithes were paid off. On that day, when you know that you've paid what you owed to the Kohen, to the Levi, to the Ani, then you finally possess that which is yours. Then you really own the rest of the produce. And that simcha that you now, the fact that you now own the rest of the produce, that's the simcha of Tisha B'Av. Of Tu B'Shvat. There's simcha on Tisha B'Av also, but we'll leave that for later. On Tu B'Shvat. So finally, this is the day after I've dispensed after I have dispensed all of my obligations, this is the first time that I actually own all of my produce, and that is the simcha of the day. Now, Rav Moshe takes us a step further, and this is truly beautiful. Paragraph base. V'hinei, gam bizman hazeh, tzarech ha'adam leida, keep, I'm in number 9, paragraph base. Now, this is very beautiful in an agrarian society. But again, it doesn't help me all that much. Again, I'm not dispensing shumas and maestros. So what do I do with all of this? So it says Ramosha something so beautiful. This is so beautiful. In reality, the entire world was created for everyone. Now, what does this mean? This is an amazing insight. Rav Moshe says, if you think about how the world is created, the same way that we often think Levi was never given a portion. No, Levi was given a portion. That portion was taken back and was then distributed amongst the other Shvatim. Says Rav Moshe, that's how it works on a global mankind level as well. The world was created, and every single human being has a portion in this world. In other words, that the way wealth distribution, this is not like a socialist comment, right? This is a theological perspective. The way the world works, the Baruch Hu created humanity, and every single human being is entitled to an equal share of the world. We all have a chelek. But what happened? That's the way it works on the empirical level. Then what happens? Ach kasher zocha echad me'ezetam ve'echad eschay me'ezetam nosna kodesh baruch hu la'zucha kam chilek ha'mischayif. But what happens? We know. But what occurs? That for whatever the cheshbon of kodesh baruch hu, the ribono shel olam gives more to some and less to others. Where does that more come from? Where does that more come from? If I have more than Reuven, where does that more come from? So Ramosha suggests that more is that God has taken Reuven's chelik and he's given it to me. He's given it to me. So Ramosha, and again, these are part of the cheshbonos v'chodesh baruch hu that we don't understand. So it's not just the pshat that I have more money than someone else's chelik has been given to me. So what happens? V'im kein hu be'etzem eino shalo. This is an incredible insight. Therefore, it turns out that if I have more than someone else, where does that more come from? It's someone else's portion that the Ribono Shel Olam has given to me. Now again, I want to be clear. I didn't go out and take anyone else's portion. I'm not actively trying to deprive anyone from their portion. But this is the way divine distribution of wealth works. And we see this, by the way, right? Isn't it an amazing thing? Don't look beyond our community. Just look at humanity. Look how it is that wealth is concentrated in certain pockets. You have incredible wealth in certain pockets, and yet other pockets that are just ridiculously destitute, barren, suffering from starvation. So how does that occur? Meaning all of humanity should be entitled to the same share. That's the way it works on the purest level. But what happens? Yibono Shel Olam, for reasons of his own divine machinations, takes wealth from some and gives it to others, which means if I have more than someone else, that means I am in possession of my share and someone else's share as well. Why is this important? Therefore, it turns out that if I have more than quote unquote my share, that's not really my wealth. That's wealth that came to me from someone else's portion. Ach, imikayim hatunam shesmu HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So here's the question. Well, if it's not my money, then what do I do? So it says in Moshe the following. The Ribono Shel Olam makes a financial contract with each of us. What's the financial contract? The financial contract is, if you give to the poor, if you take care of those who are in need, if you support worthy causes, then yiske b'chelko v'ya'aseh shalom mamish. My money only becomes my money if what? If I use the extra parts that I have to support and to help those around me. And by the way, you understand what an insight into tzedakah this is? You see, we often translate tzedakah as how? It's charity. But that's not a true etymological definition. The real definition of tzedakah is justice. What does it mean, justice? If somebody has a lot of money. So, Baruch Hashem, of course, I want to be clear. It's not, you know, I never like saying, well, it's all from God. Of course it's all from God, but you also have to put in your hishtatlus. You have to work hard. So a person works hard, they make a good parnasa, so they bring in a lot of money. That's incredible. But that's not yours. That's not yours. What that is the Ribbono Shel Olam has made you the custodian for his money, and for whatever reason, he has allocated you to you more than your portion. Why do you have that additional allocation? It's not just for me. Can I enjoy it? Of course I could enjoy it. Can I get benefit from it? Of course I could get benefit from it. But understand, that's someone else's money. So if it's someone else's money, then what? I have to figure out the way I become the Shaliach Hashem to get that money back to the original owner of that portion. Now again, obviously, I can never know who the original... But again, when I see those in need, I look at them as the owners of my additional portion. And it is my obligation to get that money back where it needs to go. And only once I get that money back to its quote-unquote original owner, only then do I become the rightful owner on my portion. While I'm still holding on to someone else's portion, that money is not mine. Only once I dispense what truly belongs to the other, only once I engage in tzedakah, not charity, but justice, this is what is supposed to be done, then and only then does the money that is my portion truly become mine. Achmach mashin, so skip down a little bit. Lachein, tzarech lilmod mimaiser. Paragraph Dalet. Shalachal apachos l'yachrem shana l'chaverta. So Rav Moshe says, so what do we learn? As much as we don't live in an agricultural society, the take-home message is clear. The same way that God says, do not delay in handing out what does not belong to you. Do not delay in handing out what is truly and rightfully the portion of the other. What applies to our crops, what applies to our trees, what applies to our fruits, applies to our money as well. He says a person should not delay in dispensing their tzedakah from 1 year to the next. U'b'chol shana ya'aseh cheshbon v'yitein chelek hatzedakah. Every single year a person has to make a cheshbon, has to make a calculation about how much charity they're going to dispense, and they should dispense it efficiently and expeditiously. Again, I want to be clear. Of course, we know that even in Hilchos Tzedakah, we have limitations, right? Chazal, the rabbis put a cap on the amount of tzedakah you are allowed to dispense in order that a person does not self-impoverish. But nevertheless, a person should go ahead and dispense whatever they can. And if a person goes ahead and gives, not just in one lump sum, but gives every month or gives every week, it's even better. Now, by the way, just as an aside, what Rav Moshe is alluding to over here is the following. Rav Moshe once received the following question. And the question was, you know, things haven't changed all that much. It's not a new phenomenon that people get, Baruch Hashem, a ton of tzedakah solicitations in the mail. Ton of tzedakah solicitations. Right? Compound that with people who come house to house. Compound that with people who we see in shul. There's a lot of tzedakah solicitations that come our way each and every day. So the question that was posed to Rav Moshe is the following. Is it better to give a lot to a little or to give a little to a lot? In other words, let's say I have $1,000 to give to tzedakah. So, you know, I could give $1,000 to one institution and it could really make a significant difference. Or I could give $250 to four institutions and that's also significant. Or I could send $10 to 100 solicitations that come my way. It's a really profound question. So Rav Moshe says, what should I do? So Rav Moshe's tshuva is actually amazing. Rav Moshe paskins that it is better to give a little to a lot. It is better to give as many times as possible. Why Rav Moshe says? Because that habituates a person to become a giver. And the amazing part is that once you become accustomed to being a giver, you realize that what? You actually have a lot more to give. When you condition yourself to always give, even if it's just a little bit at each and every clip, that creates a giving persona. And once I have that giving persona, I realize that I have more opportunities, more resources, and more abilities to give, just as one more aside on the aside. It's a beautiful story that Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, when he was a young boy, what he used to do with is the following. So his parents would give him, I'll just use like the equivalent of like a dollar for tzedakah. And what he would do is he would go ahead and he would ask his parents for 100 pennies instead. And he would go over to the pushka. If you can imagine, he would take the penny, he would say, Hineni muchan muzum lakai mitzah saseh shal tzedakah. Here, behold, I'm ready to fulfill the positive commandment of tzedakah. He put in a penny. And he would do it over and over and over again, 100 times. Just as a little boy, he did this. Why? To sensitize himself to becoming a giver. because that's the most, if you could sensitize yourself to becoming a giver. You know, we always speak about this. People give an altar. Not everybody has the ability to give an incredible amount of money, but that's okay. There are so many other beautiful ways. Giving money is wonderful, but you know what? Giving money isn't always the best form of the gift either, because not every situation calls for money. Some situations call for an attentive ear. Some situations call for a shoulder to cry on. There are plenty of ways to give. But the goal ultimately is to become a regular giver. So the Moshe says, that's what this teaches us, to be able to give and to give on a regular basis. The Moshe says, it's good to give yearly, even better to give monthly, even better to give every week. You know what the best? The best is give every single day. Give every single day. V'zeh halimud yodin anu midin tu b'shvat. And says Rav Moshe, where do we learn this concept from? We learn this from Tu Bishvat. Shebazeh na'aseh ha'nishar shalanu. So Rav Moshe says, you know what, the simcha, right? What is the Yom Tov experience of Tu Bishvat? Why is it such a happy day? Because this is the day when everything we have actually becomes ours. But how does it become ours? How do we ultimately assert our ownership? Ultimately, over our possessions, we only assert ownership through giving to others. And Tu B'Shvat, which was the day where a person essentially had to make sure that they had given all of their chumas and maestras, this is the day that reminds us that it's only by giving to others that we are able to acquire for ourselves. And that's the Simcha of Tu B'Shvat. That's the beautiful happiness of this day. Through giving to others, we're able to acquire for ourselves. Incredible, incredible idea. That's the first approach. That would be enough. If I just gave you Rav Moshe, dayenu. But I'll share with you something additional as well, another beautiful approach. So this is from the Sefer Zecher David. The Sefer Zecher David was written by Rav David of Modena, who lived in the 16th century, a great Kabbalist. So he wrote the following. He says, he makes an interesting observation. If you go back for just a moment, to number 3, I'll show you something very interesting, that in the Mishnah it says the following. In the Mishnah it says that there are Arba Rosh Hashanah, there are 4 New Years. And the Mishnah then goes through the various New Years, says, for example, the first of Nisan is the Rosh Hashanah for kings, and everything is phrased in the plural. Yet, interestingly enough, for example, the first of Tishrei is the new year for years, plural, Shmitin, plural, Yovlos, plural. But yet, when it comes to Shvat, it says Rosh Hashanah li'ilan. See, following the linguistic symmetry of the Mishnah, what it should have said is that Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah le
Ilanos,
for trees, plural. Right? And often, by the way, when we speak about Tu B'Shvat is often quoted as the Rosh Hashanah le Ilanos, right? Plural, because that makes sense. But again, in the Mishnah, it's quoted as the singular, le Ilan. So David Modena quotes in the Zohar something quite beautiful. He says, Rosh Hashanah li'ilan, la'ashmoina, look at the underlined lines, shehu Rosh Hashanah l'chol ish Yisrael. That Rosh Hashanah ultimately, again, is a true new year for every single Jew. Ki ha'adam mechuna li'ilan. For man is compared to a tree. Shene'emar, ki ha'adam eitz hasodeh. So here, Rav David Modena, the Sefer David, says something absolutely amazing. Quoted from the Zohar, the idea that Rosh Hashanah le'ilan is the Mishnah making a veiled allusion, a scriptural allusion to the idea, or the, I should say, a textual allusion to the idea that Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah not just for the trees in the field, but it's a Rosh Hashanah le'ilan. It is a Rosh Hashanah for the tree. Who is the tree? Take a look at number 11. Remember again, we see in Parashas Kisetzi, the Torah tells us, Torah is talking about the laws of a siege. And so the Torah says, Kisatzrel ir yamim rabim, if you will lay siege to a city for many days, li lachem al to do war against latafsa, lo sashchis es eitza, lindoach ala garzen. Do not go ahead and unnecessarily destroy trees. By the way, this is the prohibition of bat hashchis. This is the prohibition that you cannot unnecessarily destroy things if you don't need to. See, even if you're going ahead and you're laying siege to a city, you know, one of the oldest military strategies is what's called the scorched earth policy, or the scorched earth strategy, where what? You burn everything. You burn everything. Now, why would you do that? See, if you win, you've just ruined all the natural resources. But if you lose, at least what you've done is you've dealt your enemy a significant blow. So the Torah says, we don't believe in scorched earth policies. We do not, which happens to speak to the Jewish view of optimism, which we're not going to get into right now. But the idea the Torah is telling us is, if you need to chop down the trees, because it's necessary from a military perspective, of course you can do. But to just destroy things, that you can't do. And now the Torah says, Ki Adam Eitzah Sad Lavo Lefanecha B'Matzor. Now, the way Rashi reads this phrase is as an interrogative. Ki Adam Eitzah Sad, is the tree a combatant? Is the tree your enemy? Is the tree a soldier that you have to go ahead, who's going into the siege before you? So Rashi reads it as an interrogative. The way that Kabbalistic writings understand this is as a statement. Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh. Man is like a tree of the field. So therefore, again, the Zecher David says something beautiful. That what the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah is alluding to us is that Tu B'Shvat is not just the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos, because it doesn't say Ilanos. Yes, it's true for the fruits of the tree, but it's also Rosh Hashanah for Le'ilan, for the tree. That Tu B'Shvat is also Rosh Hashanah for man. That this is also an opportunity for us to begin again. What does this mean that Tu B'Shvat is Rosh Hashanah for man? So take a look at number 12. I want to share with you a couple of ideas. Because this metaphor of Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh, that man is a tree, is an exceptionally profound one. What does it mean that we're a tree? So look at the Ma'aral writes in number 12. The Ma'aral in Netzach Yisrael says, Ki Be'emes Ha'adam Nikra Eitz Hasadeh. Man is called a tree of the field. Dechsiv Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh. But you look at the Ma'aral's wording over here. He says, Rak Shehu Ilan Hafuch. Man is an upside down tree. What does he mean as an upside down tree? Ki ha'etz sharasha lemata takua ba'aretz. A regular physical tree, its roots are in the earth, and therefore again it's pulled into the earth. Ve'ilu ha'adam sharasha lemala. Man's roots do not extend downwards. Man's roots extend upwards. Such a beautiful insight. Ki ha'neshama hu shoresh shalo. Because the neshama is the true root of man, v'himin ha'shamayim, and ultimately, again, the origins of that soul, the origins of that neshama, are not here in the earth, but rather, again, on the celestial sphere. So he goes on, lamu ilan hafach, skip down a little bit, ki ha'etz sharash lamata, ki ha'etz chiyusa min ha'adama, the tree is nourished from its roots in the ground, v'ha'adam chiyus nishmasa min ha'shamayim, but man, his entire nourishment, his nutrients, his life force, comes from above. Such a beautiful, beautiful insight and such a beautiful metaphor. So using the Ma'aral, Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh, if Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilon, what Tu B'Shvat represents for us is the following idea. As nature is beginning to reemerge, as nature is beginning to come back to life, we have to ask ourselves one simple question. How are my roots doing? What is the nature of my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What is the nature of my connection with God? Now, I know this sounds like a strange question, but we know, you know, a person could be behaviorally observant. A person could be doing all they're obligated to do on a behavioral perspective and have absolutely no relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Simei, you know, Rav Soloveitchik said, I quoted this before. He says, you know, my father taught me Hilchos Shabbos, the Rav says. My father taught me how to observe Shabbos. My mother taught me how to experience Shabbos. There are two dramatically different parts to our Yiddishkeit. There's the behavioral piece, and there's the neshamatic piece. There's what I feel, and there's what I do. And unfortunately, you know, the great machala, the great challenge of our dar, it used to be that observance was the challenge. I remember my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, how my mother tells me that one of her earliest childhood memories is how, again, they often would not have enough food, right, in the house. Why? My grandparents were immigrants here after the war, because my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, lost his job every single Erev Shabbos. Because he would not work on Shabbos for any amount of money in the world, and he could not hold down a job. So every single week was the same story. New job, new job, new job. We don't live in that world anymore. We don't live in that world. You could go ahead and occupy the highest offices in the land, right? You could be the son-in-law of the highest, right, office in the land, and you could be a Shomer Shabbos. You could be a again, you have to understand what that means. What that means, Shabbos observance is no longer any kind of obstacle to whatever you want to do in life. So what is, every dar has this challenge, what's our challenge? Our challenge is not with the observance and the Jewish behaviors. Our challenge is the Jewish soul. So many of us have lost that feeling. We know what to do. I know I'm proficient tomorrow after. I can be Shomer Shabbos. I can do all the different things. But I don't feel it in my neshama. I don't feel a connection. I don't feel a relationship. I don't feel any type of passion towards the emotional. Again, I'm not at risk. I'm not going off the derech. I'm not going to throw in my Yiddishkeit. I'm going to continue to do everything. Because again, that's what I do. That's what I do. That's just part. I drink coffee in the morning and I keep Shabbos. I like to eat lunch and I keep kashrus. There's no challenge because our behaviors aren't challenged. We could do whatever we want, be a part of society, and we do not have to check our religious behaviors. But so many of us go through the motions with no feeling. There's something wrong with the roots. The behaviors are there. The tree is there. But the roots no longer feel like they're extending heavenward. Says the Maral, says the Tzeir David, that's Tu Bishvat. As nature begins to reblossom, as the roots begin to channel precious nutrients into the trees, into the fruits, it's a time for us to take a step back and ask ourselves, how are the roots doing? How are the roots? Not what am I keeping? Not what am I doing? Those are important questions also. Not how much more, what should I take on? A much simpler question. How is my connection to the Ribono Shel Olam? Do I feel connected? Do I feel like I'm in love with him? Do I think he's in love with me? Of course, he's in love with all of us. But how does that relationship feel? Is it warm? Is it passionate? Is it beautiful? Or like, is it a bit stagnant and stale? And if it is stagnant and stale, which you'd be surprised when a person begins to think about that, is the answer that many of us come up with. Because again, we're very embedded in our behaviors, but not always embedded in our passionate feelings. Tu Bishvat, therefore, says the Zecher David, based on the Maral, is the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilon. It's the time for us to check our roots. It's the time for us to check our connection. It's the time for us not to check our behaviors, but ultimately to check about the nature of the quality of our relationship and our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the tree metaphor. Ki Adam Eitz HaSoda. One more. Take a look at number 13. So this is from the Sefer Be'er HaParash. He writes here something so beautiful. Oh, the Be'in Ha'adam Eitz HaSada. Along with just trying to figure out this metaphor of Kiya Adam Eitz HaSada. Echon mi chasir av HaKadosh Baal HaTanya, Zichus Yagin Aleinu, Haya Oved Godol, Shaya Tov L'Shamayim Achlo, Haya Meitiv L'Brios Klal. So first of all, again, in understanding the metaphor of Kiya Adam Eitz HaSada, is that number one, in understanding that we are a tree, we are only as strong as our roots. That's lesson number one. We are only as strong as our roots. The tree could be beautiful, could be strong. If the roots are not siphoning off from the earth nutrients and nourishment, the tree will die. If we don't check our roots, again, our roots don't grow like this, our roots grow like that, then ultimately, again, we could be wonderfully behaviorally and totally dead and dormant on the inside. Ki Adam Eitz HaSada, Tu Bishvat is the time, ultimately, again, to check our roots. That's number one. Number two, look at number 13. So a story with one of the chassidim of the Baal HaTanya, who said, Haya Ovi Gadol Shehaya Tov L'Shamayim Achlov Haya Meitiv L'Brios Klal. So ultimately, again, he was very good, meaning he was good in his Ben Adam L'Makom. He was good in his relationship with God, but not so good in his relationship with other people. So what happened? Which, by the way, happens. It's much easier, by the way, to have a good relationship with God than people. For one simple reason, which is, right? God doesn't usually talk back to us, right? And the Baal Shalom doesn't do. So again, you see this all the time. People who are wonderful to God and terrible to other people. So what happens? Karlo Rabov Amarlos. Listen to this. So the Baal Tanya calls over his chassid and he says to him, Hinei HaKasav Omer, Ki Ha'adam Eitz HaSoda. The pasuk says, man is like a tree of the field. V'hadimyon shebein adam la'atzi asada. What is the comparison between man and the trees of the field? Ki kamo atzi asada af sha'aitz shu gadol biyofi. V'hadol Hashem etiferas. So a tree, it could be beautiful, it could be grand, it could have magnificent branches that sprout out in every direction. But here's the issue. Im eino no sein peros, eino kiem ilan srak. A tree that does not produce fruit is stunted. It might be great for shade, and it might be great ultimately to be chopped up into firewood. But if it doesn't give fruit, its growth is stunted. Such a tree in the world of trees is not so important. So the Baal Tanya gives Moser to his chassid. He said, the same thing is true with people. A person could be great in their Torah, in their learning. A person could be great in their avodas Hashem. Im eino no sein mishalo peros la'achirim. But if he doesn't produce fruit for others, then harehu kisrak. He's like a barren tree. So building on this, the Baal HaTanya teaches us, Ki Adam eats hasada, that just as the tree produces fruit, it's the obligation of a person to produce fruit as well. What fruit? So here's what's amazing. We say this every single day in Birchas HaTorah. Take a look at number 15. I'm skipping a little bit just because of time. Number 15 is the last paragraph in Birchas HaTorah, which again we say every morning, which is actually a composite of a number of different sources. It's a composite of the Mishnah Maseches Peh, which I have over here, number 14, a Gemara in Kiddushin, a Gemara in Shabbos, all blended together. And what do we say every single day? Elu dvarim sha'adam ochel peroseim ba'olam hazeh, va'keren chayem es di'olam haba. These are the things that a person could ultimately eat of their fruit in this world, but the principle is preserved for the world to come. Now what this Mishnah is referring to over here are certain deeds that are so powerful that you could reap the benefits in this world, but yet there is still so much more reward for these acts in the world to come as well. But the way I'd like to use this particular bracha, this particular Mishnah, is that these are the peros. What the Mishnah is teaching me as we begin our day is, okay, I want to be a tree. And I want to be a fruit tree, because I don't want to be a barren tree. I don't want to just be a tree that looks nice, looks all beautiful, looks all wonderful, stands there, and everybody says, but at the end of the day, it doesn't produce anything. Ki ha'adam eitz hasada. Remember again, when the Torah says that man is like a tree, Torah doesn't mean an ilan srak, a barren tree, it means a fruit tree. So what are the fruits that we have to produce each and every day? And this is what the Mishnah is telling us. Eluhein. And we're going to go through the list. Kibud avayim. Honoring my parents. The first fruit that a person has to produce is normal familial relationships. Every family has its dynamics. I should say differently. Every family has its dysfunctional dynamics. Every single family has, it's funny, I could tell you the dysfunctional people in my family. Of course, it's not me. I'm the fully functional one. It's never me. It's always someone else. I have news. Very often it's me, and very often it's you, and very often it's everyone, and very often it's just you. Often we create levels of dysfunction in ways that we don't even, we're so convinced that we're right. We're so convinced that everyone else has the problem that we forget to look inside. The first pre, kibbutz avim, honoring your parents, doesn't just mean honoring your parents. It means normalized familial relationships. We have to get along with our family. It's not always easy. It often comes with incredible challenges. Every family has its dynamic. Every family has its difficulties. But if you can't forge normative relationships with your family, it's going to be difficult to forge normative relationships with others. Sigmund Freud wasn't the first one to advance the idea that if you have a bad relationship with your parents, it colors every other relationship in life. Chazal had it way before Freud. That's kibbutz avim. If I can't get along with my parents, you see this all the time, unfortunately, discord within a family. I want to be clear, we often have an expectation that families are supposed to be loving and tight-knit and wonderful. And look, that's great. But that's not always possible. Relationships are difficult because they require the buy-in of others. You can't always have that loving, tight-knit family that you would like. But you could have shalom. You could try for, we'll discuss shalom a little bit. You could try to get along, that it should be that people could coexist. Some families, anytime that there's a simcha, it becomes the greatest, everybody gets a knot in their kishkas. Why? Oh, well, this one can't sit next to that one. And they haven't spoken in 20 years. No one knows why. They probably don't know why. But we know we don't talk to them. So tragic. And if that's the dynamics you have in your backyard, if that's the dynamics you have in your family, trust me when I tell you, that will spill over to your other life relationships. Because it is impossible to have heightened dysfunction in your immediate family and carry on normally in your other life relationships. Again, I want to be clear. There are certainly exceptions, and sometimes there are traumatic events within families. Sometimes there are horrible issues. I'm not talking about those situations. Those are the outliers. I'm talking about, Baruch Hashem, in normal familial dynamics and dysfunction. The first step is you have to create shalom in our families. That's the first pre. Next, gemilos chasodim. Gemilas chasadim means what? Chasad, but it really means selflessness. It's important to lead a selfless life. The Jew asks themselves one question every day when you get up in the morning, and it is, what am I going to do for the world today? It's not what am I going to do for me. It's not how am I going to make myself. What am I going to do for the world today? Now, by the way, you change the world even by changing your backyard, right? You do a chesed for someone who's in your family, who's a friend, who's in your community, who's in your shul. anything you do, but that's the way you start. My life is not about me. I'm a Baal Chesed. To be a Baal or Baal as Chesed doesn't mean someone who does good things. It means someone who is a selfless individual. Life is not about me. I am not the center of the universe. Life has to be about others. Next. V'hashkamas beis hamedrash shachris v'arvis. Waking up early, getting to the first of the beis hamedrash, and lastly, now I know what you're thinking. Shoo, this doesn't apply to me. It does. It does, and I'll tell you why. Yes, on a literal sense, for a man, what it means is, and ladies, the chilek you have in this is, you have to urge your husbands. You have to urge your husbands, again, in a kind, nice way. Don't become a mashkiach, and don't become a rosh yeshiva. You're not in charge of your husband's soul. Your husband is in charge of his soul. But, in a beautifully nuanced, nudging, wifely way, a wife could have an incredible impact on her husband with positive encouragement. But so that's one possibility. The other possibility is, what does it mean? Hashkama space hamedrash shachris arvis. Spirituality has to bookend our lives. My day has to start with spirituality, shachris, and it has to end with spirituality, arvis. I have to make sure that I have bookends of ruchnius in my life. Start your day with something ruchni, something spiritual, and you fill in the blank. For some it might be tefillah, for some it might be tzedakah, for some it might be chesed, for some it might be learning, whatever it is. Your day has to start with ruchnius, and your day has to end with ruchnius. Because those who go ahead and bookend their lives, their days, with ruchnius, become truly spiritual beings. Hachnasas archim is the next pre. What's hachnasas archim? Generosity. Generosity, by the way, generosity is different than selflessness. A person could often be selfish, I think about others, but yet, when it comes to sharing my stuff, I'm not as ready to do that. Hachnasas Archim means, I have to recognize, let's go back to what Moshe said before, if Baruch Hashem I have, if I'm blessed with things, with stuff, it's not just for me. Rav Shlomo is saying to me, go, get out, give. Invite people in and take from what's in your home and give it out. That's Hachnasas Archim. Next, Biker Cholim. Biker Cholim is visiting the sick. What it also means is empathy. Empathy. A person has to be an empathic individual. Possessing empathy and the ability to feel the pain of the other. You know, so often what we do is, and by the way, if you want to become a real ba'alas empathy, the best way to do it is, all you need to do is open up the newspaper. On a very basic level. And you look at the tragedy and suffering that is happening in this world. A Jew should feel that. And it doesn't matter where it's happening. It doesn't matter if it's happening in the Middle East, or if it's happening in Africa, or if it's happening in Asia. Wherever it is, you have to feel it. We have to become empathic individuals. Because you know what happens if you're not empathic? You know what happens if I don't have a Biker Cholim personality? You become self-absorbed. And the worst midah in life is self-absorption. The worst midah of life is when you think the world revolves around you, because then everything begins to crumble. Biker Cholim means empathy. Next, hachnasas kala. What's hachnasas kala? So yes, of course, on a literal level, if you know that somebody is struggling, the kala is struggling to get married, again, whether that's in terms of thinking of shiduchim or helping to go ahead and pay for the chasana, of course, but I think on a grand level, what it means is sharing in the simcha of another. You know, sometimes a person has a simcha, and perhaps it's a simcha that I have not yet been granted. Whether it's marrying off a child, whether it's a chasana, whether it's a Chanukah sabayis, and sometimes there's a little bit of like a begrudging feeling. So ultimately, again, hachnosas kala means share in the simcha of others. Levayas hames means share in the tzaras of others. You know what ends up happening often by tzaras? Is that a tzara happens, something tragic occurs, and what happens? Everybody is there to help, and everybody is there surrounding a fam, surrounding a mishkan. But then you know what happens? What happens? So again, Shiva ends, Shloshim ends, the 12 months, and everybody goes back to their regular lives. But meanwhile, again, the person that suffered that loss is by themselves. It's by themselves. They've been forgotten because everyone assumes that life has gotten back to normal. That's Levayas Hames. Continue to escort the dead. Continue to be there. Continue to share in the tzara of another. Iyun Tfila. When you daven, don't just daven for yourself. Don't just daven for yourself, but daven for others as well. And by the way, I want to tell you a very important secret. You know, you don't have to know the name of someone to daven for them. Meaning, here's the good news. All the names you don't know, the Ribono Shel Olam does know. Mm-hmm. And to put in you, when you say Rifa'inu, to daven for all, not just for the 25 people you have on your Biker Cholim list. Ribono Shel Olam, I know that there are thousands of others out there who I don't even know them, and I'll never know them. But I know they need Rifa'inu, and you know them because you hear their cries every single day. remember them as well. I don't know their names, but I don't need to know their names to daven for them. I don't need to know their names to think about them. I don't need to know their names to feel their pain, to have that empathy. That's iyun tefillah. Don't just daven for yourself. And don't just daven for your family. Don't just daven for your friends. Or don't just daven for your holiness, or your shidduch list, or your parnasah list. Daven for everyone. Keep everyone in mind. Havas shalom bin adam l'chaveira. Do whatever you can to make shalom. Do whatever you can to make shalom. You know, is it, so you ask people, of course, I'm not going to ask anyone to raise your hand if you love shalom. Right? Because everybody, at least normal people, love shalom. But here's the interesting part when it comes to shalom. Like the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, I know we're going late. But as the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, the Mishnah says that having mitamid of shalom, you have to be of the disciples of Aaron. Love peace, but loving peace is not enough. You have to be a rodef, you have to run after peace. So Rabbi Tursky comments on this so beautifully. He says, what does it mean to be a rodef shalom? Being a rodef shalom ultimately means peace rarely shows up at your doorstep. Right? You know, say, peace, I'm ready, bring it in. Right? Right, back it up, I'm ready, I'm all ready, I'm all about shalom. Right? I'm ready for it whenever. No, if you want shalom in life, you have to run after it. And when we say running after it, you have to be willing to make concessions. And you have to be willing to be mavat. You have to be willing to yield. And you have to be willing to give up certain entitlements. That's what it means to make shalom, to be a real lover of peace. Va'ava shalom bin adam l'chaveiro means you have to be willing to give up, to concede, to yield, and to be mavater. And lastly, v'talmud Torah k'neged kulam. And with this we'll end. Talmud Torah k'neged kulam. Now again, very often the way this is understood in a very, I'll call it in a more litvisha fashion, is that what the Mishnah is teaching me is, and learning Torah is the most important thing. So I'll tell you, my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, told me a beautiful, with this I'm going to end, really. He told me a beautiful, beautiful insight into this Talmud Torah K'neged Kulam. And he gave a mashal. The mashal he gave, you know, it used to be the custom in Europe that the president of the Kehillah was often the wealthiest man in the town. So what happened? So the president one morning, one Shabbos, walked into shul, and he was wearing a magnificent overcoat. And after davening, so all the people flocked around him, a beautiful overcoat, wonderful. They were looking at it, admiring the detail. And there was a pauper in the Kehillah. And the pauper saw all the covet that this president was getting because of the coat. And this guy, this pauper, was marginalized his whole life. No one ever paid any attention. He said, you know what? Whatever it takes, I'm going to save up enough money. I'm going to buy the coat. I'm going to buy a coat. So weeks and weeks and weeks, he saves up. Finally, he buys the coat. He walks into shul expecting mamish everyone to give him such covet, such compliments. And he sees that people are like pointing and laughing. And he's heartbroken. He's suffered through many weeks of privation in order to get this coat. And now they're just pointing and laughing. So heartbroken, he goes over to the president and says, I don't understand. I got the same exact coat from you, same details from Hatbox, just like yours. Everything, the same exact thing, right? It's even the Shana coat, you know, it's everything. How come when you got it, you got so many compliments, and I get it and they make fun of me. The president, let me explain something to you. See, I have the full package. I have the beautiful suit and the shined shoes, and I'm well-groomed, and my hat looks nice. Your clothing is tattered. So for me, the coat is a beautiful compliment to an already organized ensemble. But you, your clothing is tattered. Your shoes are all scuffed. You're unkempt. And so when you put on the coat amplifies all of your shortcomings. The coat looks totally out of place and draws attention to all of the other things on you that are out of order. So my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, said, that's the pshat. Talmud Torah K'neged Kulam means, Torah is the overcoat. Torah is the beautiful overcoat. If you have all of the other peros, if you have all of the other trappings, if you have the nice suit of chesed, if you have the pressed shirt of empathy, if you have the hat of shalom in your family, if you have the whole package, then when you put on the overcoat of Torah, it's a magnificent final touch to a beautiful outfit. If on the other hand, every other part of you is in a state of disrepair, then the coat of Torah looks awkward, then the coat of Torah looks out of place, and the coat of Torah simply magnifies all of the other shortcomings. Or to put in our context here, Torah is the trunk of the tree. Torah is the trunk. But the trunk is only meaningful if the trunk is able to go ahead and sprout out all of the different peros. If the trunk is just sitting there by itself, but the branches are barren, It draws attention to the inability of the trunk to be able to create anything magnificent. So if we tie this all together, now we begin to understand the true beauty of Tu B'Shvat. What's Tu B'Shvat? So we saw again, Rav Moshe taught us that Tu B'Shvat ultimately is the day when our possessions really become ours. Why? Because it's the day when we have to, in an agricultural society, go ahead and dispense all of our trumos, maestros. So this is the day when, after I give away the portion that belonged to others, I was in possession, I gave away the portion to others, then what's mine is mine. Oh, that's a simcha. Finally, I own what I have. That's approach number one. Approach number two, we saw in the Zecher David that the beauty of Tu B'Shvat is ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh. Because Tu B'Shvat is not just Rosh Hashanah li'ilanos, it's Rosh Hashanah li'ilan. It is Rosh Hashanah for the tree. Who is the tree? Ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh. Man is the tree. So what does it mean, man is the tree? Tu B'Shvat offers us the opportunity, explains the Maharal, to examine our roots. Not to examine our behaviors. Our behaviors are usually pretty good. But to examine the roots. What is my level of connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Are the roots alive? Are the roots pumping in nourishment? Or have the roots withered and died? And if they did, Tu B'Shvat offers me the opportunity to re-examine those roots and to try to figure out how to reinvigorate them. And then again, based on the Babcher, the Balatanya, the Mishnah, Meseches Peah, to ultimately, Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh teaches us that man is only as strong as his roots. Right? Excuse me. And therefore, we have to reconsider. We said that before. And furthermore, again, based on the Mishnah and Peah, we learn that if Torah is the real trunk of us, if Torah is the essence of us, we only become truly vibrant if we're a tree that doesn't just have a trunk, but if we're a tree ultimately that produces fruit. The fruits of generosity, the fruits of empathy, the fruits of family, the fruits of selflessness, the fruits of sharing in the pain of others, sharing in the simchas of others, the fruits of davening for others, and the fruits of all of these beautiful midos. Tu B'Shvat is the opportunity where we have to look at the tree we are and ask ourselves a simple question. Are we producing the requisite fruits or not? If we are, incredible. Chances are, we're not. We're at least not producing all of the fruits. And so Tu B'Shvat, this Rosh Hashanah for Elon, gives us the opportunity to take a step back and ask ourselves, I have the trunk and I have the roots. How could I begin to produce the magnificent fruits? So we should be Zocha Meretz Hashem to be able to celebrate the beautiful trunk of Torah that we each possess. But I merit Hashem to find the koach, to find the courage, and to find the strength to begin to produce beautiful fruit.